This is Coda Radio, episode 566 for April 17th, 2024. Hey friend, welcome into Jupiter Broadcasting's weekly talk show, taking a pragmatic look at the art and the business of software development and the world of technology. My name is Chris, and joining me over there, the time traveling man that he is, it's our host, Mr. Dominic. Hello, Mike.
Time is a construct you humans have developed. The Daleks will destroy it.
Oh, man. That sounds bad. Well, then, would I have unlimited time if time was destroyed, or am I gone? I guess we'd have to clarify that first.
Linux is eternal. Daleks are just angry Linux mailing list users.
Now, you know, apparently what's eternal is the floppy disk. Mm. As we probably suspected, there was many out there in production. Well, it turns out San Francisco's light rail runs on floppy disk even today. They write, it's a question of risk, so they're looking at migrating off. The system is currently working just fine, but we know that with each increasing year, the risk of data degradation on the floppy disk increases, and at some point it's going to be a catastrophic failure. The agency installed this system in 1998, and it's still going. They want to replace it with something that covers like all the various light rails and is online. But they're swapping floppy disk still in 2024 to run the San Francisco light rail system.
Well, this is just like the COBOL story from the Florida unemployment office during COVID, right? Literally couldn't find people at any price.
Yeah. Yeah, and they say, we're hoping that a large component of the money will come from the state and federal grants, but the rest has to come from just the regular general supply, and they don't really have the money to cover it, let alone the right team. Pretty wild. Since 1998, they've been running this system. And, you know, traditionally in these industries, they expected these things to last a very, very long time. I mean, you know, it's an old industry. Well, trains are, not light rail. And technology just moved on a lot faster. It's kind of impressive the disks are still working. It really blows me away.
You know, you got to give it to them, right? Some of this old technology is pretty good.
They think it's going to be a multi-phase, decade-long project to migrate off of it, too. Can you believe that?
Yeah. Yes, I do.
Yeah, I do, too, actually. Coder.show/membership. This is a value-for-value podcast, and that means that if you got a little bit of value from this, or you enjoyed your time listening, or made you think about something, or maybe it even got you worked up, but you liked it. I don't know you. I'm not your daddy, but if you got some value, we ask you contribute a little bit back. And you can do that with a monthly membership at coder.show/membership. As a thank you, we will give you an ad-free version of the show so you don't hear things like this. And you're also supporting the show directly. We do a Coder QA special release for our members usually. And when we can, I'll also give members a discount on the swag. There's other little things that we just try to do for our members because they do mean so much to us. And this has been a prolonged ad winter, so your support means more than ever on keeping the show going. You can also support each production directly with a boost using a new podcast app, podcastapps.com. Fountain is really fantastic because their Strike integration makes it so easy to top off and boost. You don't have to worry about like figuring out sats and like sending them around or hodling them, whatever. You just boom, buy them a Strike and go. I think also the Podverse app is something to at least consider. It's a really great app. And it's open source and cross-platform and has a web version, too. And I love that because I can be listening in my car and I get to the studio or, you know, work. And I can finish up at my desktop on my big screen with my big speakers while I work or with my headphones when I have them hooked up. It's really, really super convenient to have it on all three platforms and the web. That's Podverse. And Cast-O-Matic is like chef's kiss for iOS. It's not available for Android, but it's such a great app. Any one of those, there's more, too, like True Fans and others, that lets you boost in. You can send in little Satoshis to the show or lots of Satoshis, whatever you feel like the right amount of value for the Coder Radio program is. It's coder.show/membership, or go get something like Fountain, Podverse, or Cast-O-Matic and boost the show. And we really do appreciate that support. And I bet we still have some of those Darth Jar Jar promo codes available. So if you jump in when I get back from time traveling to Texas, I'll give a shout out to our new members. That's coder.show/membership and podcastapps.com. Well, I know it's been a little bit now since the XE vulnerability excited the world with the backdoor that was discovered, but it has, I think, created a good discussion again around funding open source. Yet I don't really think like we've seen anything at least as we record this, really develop that answers this. And you had a post over at DominicM.com on open source's funding fiasco. And tell me what inspired you to write this.
Yeah, so, you know, for years we've been talking about this, right? This has been like kind of our one of our bete noirs. You know, we've been doing the show, what, is it 12 years now? I feel like it's 12 years. Let's assume I'm right.
Yeah.
And damn, like, it's just not solved. So I kind of went through and I looked at the different models of open source funding, right? I tried to be positive, and if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you probably know how that went. First of all, Chris, I had a Dolly generate this art specifically for your Soviet ass.
Oh, wow. It's beautiful.
I wish we did a video show just to show. These are Soviet dwarves. They're all equal, but of course, two dwarves, they're robot dwarves, are much larger than the other dwarves, and they don't appear to be actually doing anything. While there's, I don't know, what would you say, like 50 little dwarves hauling rubies?
Yeah, working.
Yeah, I have a whole series of these because I'm doing a post on Ruby open source pretty soon, or a series of posts. And so I called it Open Sources Funding Fiasco. And I go down the three most common types of open source funding. And if it works for you, Chris, I think we should just do them one by one.
Yeah, let's start with the first one you started with, which is the one that I think I've been kicking around the most, is direct employment. And I don't know if that means you hire the lead developer, or do you think maybe that means you just, if you have talent on staff, you have them start contributing to these projects, right? But
it could be both. But direct employment would be like you employ the maintainer and maybe a contributor or two. Yeah. Sounds great, right?
Yeah. I mean, if these companies are going to call these projects high priority when they have bugs, and if they're going to impact millions of customers potentially, it seems like it should be on their radar.
Almost a no-brainer.
Yeah, right, yeah. Exactly.
The problem is, what we've seen historically is, as priorities change, as the companies face pressure, particularly I think now, we're kind of at the perfect inflection point for this conversation economically, because the money printer continues to not sing us its sweet, sweet song. The companies either lay those folks off, or they reallocate them, right, reassign them to proprietary projects. Also, it's a very unequal. My whole theme here is a little Soviet, right? But Animal Farm by George Orwell. Some contributors become more equal than others. For instance, it's really easy to devote a lot of time and be super careful and a really dedicated teammate on the open source project when someone is paying you six figures to do it.
True.
It's kind of hard when you have a crying kid and, you know, a life, and you have a full-time job and all that good stuff, which is why I stopped releasing my stuff as open source. Though I wish I'm considering doing a little bit in the near future. But it's tough. It's, you know, you get those pull request demands, those issues, and let's be honest, a lot of those issues are just by, like, no offense to our pals, but, you know, junior devs who just got out of boot camp that, like, don't know how to set up a config. I'm thinking of the old library I used to support, MD Networking, and I just took it down because it wasn't worth, you know, no, man, you need to, like, you know, add the token in the header because that's what your server says, right? Read the error.
Hmm.
It's easy to say, well, don't be a jerk, but when you have 20 of these in a week and you have a full-time job or you're running a business, it's too much. Somebody needs to pay you.
I think, going back to the direct employment point, I have seen an awkward conflict of interest come up several times in the open source community. And I'm going to just use vague generalizations. I'm not going to cite a specific example, but let's just take the Fedora project for a moment. Every now and then, you see the Fedora project make decisions that actually seem like they're decisions for Red Hat, not for the Fedora community.
Who's Red Hat?
Right.
I think you mean IBM.
And the awkward tension there is that the top contributors to Fedora are all Red Hat staff, or not all, but mostly Red Hat staff. And so if Red Hat wants something to die or wants something to happen, they don't even really have to tell the staff. They don't have to direct the staff. They are intelligent humans, and they understand what the goals and ambitions of their employer are, and it just shapes their contribution sometimes. And I'm not naming names or specifics. I'm just saying these things can happen. And it creates an awkward situation where an employer is paying you full time or close to it to contribute to this project, And now the project wants to do something that the employer doesn't want done. And it doesn't happen often, and it's project specific, but it does happen. And so it, I don't know, it's like, in a way, open source should be free to do whatever the market wants it to do. But when you have certain competitors, you can sometimes have these things influence the direction of these projects. So it's not even 100%, even when it is working.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, and then you get, of course, the what if the management today is not the management tomorrow problem.
Oh, true. Yes. Yeah, where maybe it's working okay today. They're fine with you contributing, doing whatever direction the project wants, but the new management comes in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So another one you list here is consulting. I think we've seen this one a lot. Open source developers have very specialized skills. The businesses have needs. They can hire the developer as a consultant. Could be a win-win situation.
Right. I mean, that is a potential scenario very similar to employing. I was actually more thinking of a kind of the Cygnus, and if you know who those people were, that is a poor one out situation. That's way back in the day, but I know Chris remembers all those Linux. Remember when the Apache server was new? I was even too young for this, but
yeah,
you know, Linux was the new hotness. I remember this for Docker, to be honest, to tie it into some of our past content, right? Remember, we were one of the first to call Docker as like a big deal, blah, blah, blah. Yay. Mm-hmm. And well, guess what happened to Docker? There were lots of companies formed, particularly Docker itself, around being your Docker consultants, right? We're your Docker pros, DevOps, all the goodness. And who made the lion's share of the money? Who ate all the gazelles? AWS. That's pretty rough. And that is a, I mean, we don't have to go through the history of the early aughts and 90s here, but that is a, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that story keeps repeating. We just mentioned Red Hat, right? Red Hat just ended up having to be bought up by IBM.
Yeah, there's a sustainability aspect. It's kind of what you're touching on here. These things are not necessarily durable over the 10, 20 years that these projects seem to get used. The time scales are only getting longer, too. Like, these things get developed and then they get deployed. I mean, we just talked about San Francisco using floppy disk systems from 1998. So the scale of dependency, too, is massive here. And I don't think consulting covers that when it's a 20, 30-year deployment. It might maybe for a few years pays the bills, is my thought. All right. Well, what about bug bounties? This, I've seen this work.
I like bug bounties. Yeah. This is the one.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. You think?
I think it's a mix of all of them, but I really like the idea of bug bounties, right? Because if you think about it, if you're, I mean, the example from the XZ scare, you're like Microsoft or some big company, right? You want something fixed. You need it fixed now. Pay for it. Just like any little dev shop would charge you, you know, you want that. It's whatever, $8,000, whatever it costs, right? Pay for it. You know, GitHub has the tip jar, which I know people are going to yell at me for this. I think that's kind of insulting, actually.
Yeah.
I think the tip jar is bad. I feel like you should be able to say somebody opens an issue, you look at their email address. If it says, you know, at Adobe, actually, if it says at Adobe, you charge them five times as much for being assholes about the creative
cloud. Or Oracle.
Oracle seven times. I mean,
okay.
Or,
all right.
You should be able to say, I will look into that for you. My rate is, you know, an hour, right? And dollars an hour or whatever your currency is. Or you could do a flat fee. My, you know, to fix that, it'll be $5,000, whatever. Because you know, right, the Microsofts and Oracles and Adobes of the world are getting more value out of that. I mean, they're probably making millions.
Yeah.
They should pay you, right? This whole article, this whole post, and this whole conversation we've been having for over a decade comes down to, I mean, this is my assertion. I know I'm going to get some crap for it. These big companies have effectively turned open source developers into sharecroppers. It doesn't make sense. Even Docker, who is now like a relatively okay company, right? Amazon, Fly.io, DigitalOcean, Linode, two of those were former sponsors, and we love them, right? But they've gotten more value out of Docker. Heldoku became like Docker on easy mode, right? Docker with Heroku build packs. All these larger hosting and platform as a service or infrastructure as a service companies have made multi-millions of dollars off of the community's back.
Yeah.
And basically given nothing back. I mean, I'm going to go even spicier here, then jump in and stop me. The Linux Foundation's kind of a joke. And the thing that really got me was that Red Hat OpenShift basically couldn't make it. Which, what purer version of, and I didn't use it either, right? But like, if Red Hat couldn't sell you an open source platform as a service, then nobody could.
I think the foundation models are also sort of designed, the way they're designed, they're not able to really keep up with the evolving space. Like, there's so many new things that are created each year. A foundation's just too slow to keep up with that.
I mean, I don't want to name certain projects, but we've talked about before, big projects, they end up fighting about nonsense that has nothing to do with the project.
Yeah.
And the foundation's resources end up being consumed by bullshit, effectively.
Yeah.
So just pay the developers. That's my thing.
I think the real pain point here has been that the industry has evolved very rapidly. The means to grab this stuff and incorporate it into your project has only gotten easier and faster. But the ability to fund has it. And I think what you were getting at that I liked there was, like, wouldn't it be, instead of some stupid, demeaning tip jar, wouldn't it be better if you could put a price, a dollar amount on a PR? You know, like, if Microsoft wants to get a fix into something for that affects Teams, then they put a pull request in, or they put an issue in, and an FFmpeg team member, in this case, because this is the example from a couple of weeks ago, goes and assigns a dollar amount. And then once that dollar amount's been reached, they begin work on it. And there'd have to be some, like, you know, agreement on time and things like that. I mean, it's not going to be that simple.
Well, but this exists. This already exists in the world. There used to be a website, iPhone App Quotes, that I used to get a lot of early business from. They don't really exist anymore. But their whole thing was people looking for iPhone developers or iPhone apps to be built for their... A lot of them were like idea guys, but some of them were businesses. You would be like, okay, you want this. Here's some questions. Based on what you said, it'll be, you know, you could either say hourly or you could say a price. Much like Upwork, to be honest with you. And lock everybody in. Like, it's insane to me that GitHub hasn't kind of...
solved this.
Well, it's the perfect place.
I mean, taking aside more lock into Microsoft, it absolutely is. If you take that most of these projects are on there already, like in the case of FFmpeg and XZ. And then additionally, they know who contributes what. They'll even, you know, they'll break up how much time people spend on stuff. They can track all of that, so they could implement something like splits, akin to splits.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, to how much you work on the project is how much of the split you get for the bounty that was set for that issue or whatever request.
Well, and not only that, take it a step further, right, with the bug bounty thing. You know, a lot of people say, oh, do open source, and we've said it before on the show for, like, super new developers trying to break in. Well, what if you had on your GitHub profile, which, let's be honest, for devs has become effectively their business card, I fixed this bug for Microsoft. You know, we don't talk about money, right, because, you know, there are regional differences and whatever. And it's verified by the person from Microsoft who asked you. There's, like, a little check mark a la Twitter. That, to me... if I was starting out today, I would hunt those opportunities down.
Yeah.
Right. Even if there was some three-way split between, you know, the entity asking, so in this case, Microsoft, the project maintainers, and you as the individual contributor. Because that verification, you could basically say, oh, yeah, I did a job for Microsoft. So.
That's true. It would also track all of that and help your resume.
Right. And if it didn't work... presumably there'd be some process to reject it, just like, again, this is a solved problem on Upwork.
I think the one area where this probably wouldn't work would be for, like, the really kind of boring kind of work that nobody really cares about but does need to happen sometimes, that isn't sexy, that doesn't draw attention, that isn't going to get funding. You know, how do you get in this, in the bounty system, how do you get that kind of stuff funded?
Money. The same way when you call someone and say, I want you to hunt down this crazy Objective-C memory issue, and it's a pain in the ass, and it's causing us a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And it's going to take you probably like 2 weeks or something to even get any traction, because it's really obscure and this code base is, you know, 20 years old. You just pay. You got to pay.
I'm thinking more like from the perspective of an open source project that needs to do like a re-architecture of something, and they're having a hard time getting that bounty paid. Like, nobody's asking them to do it, but they know as a project that work needs to get done, but it's just not very attractive, so they're not getting paid for it.
I mean, that's the same problem every dev shop has, right? Of how do I convince my clients that they should sign a quarterly maintenance contract with me, but in their eyes, they're basically paying for nothing except these invisible updates that I say are important, but they have no idea. Right.
Right. That's fair. All right, so we need to make you president of the world to solve this?
I prefer to be chairman of the party. Is that how we do it?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Commissar? I think you should be president of the world and bring back Stowe.
Okay, and maybe Wave, Google Wave.
Oh, why would you say that?
We got lucky with this one, right? So remember we had Heartbleed. That was a Google security team.
Heartbleed was, yeah.
Yep, that found that in OpenSSL. OpenSSL did get some funding as a result. Not a lot, but they seem to be doing okay. And then in the case of XE, it was a Microsoft employee who was trying to just get Postgres working better on Linux and noticed a performance regression, a minor one at that. And we got lucky. So, but both times in those cases, it was a Google staffer and a Microsoft staffer. They're full-time employees working at these companies that were kind of tangentially working on this stuff and discovered it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say the defense of that, or not really defense, but, you know, Microsoft and Google are the kind of people who are going to be pushing your project to its limits, right?
Yeah.
You know, your average small ERP or, you know, internal enterprise app is not going to necessarily push the bounds of your package.
I'd put this out to the audience, too, and I'd love them to boost in with their thoughts, like, is it money? Is that the problem? And how do we get money to open source developers, especially ones like this XE developer who's just quietly burning out? You know, in their small bubble, people might be aware of it, but the rest of the world isn't. How do we do this? What would be your solution for funding open source development? It's still one of those questions that we don't really have great answers for. As time goes on, to me, it gets more frustrating that we don't solve it because, like you said, the technology is there. GitHub could solve this. You could solve it with just boosts. I mean, there's 100 ways you could solve this. And all we seem to see happen is large companies write checks from time to time or create little foundations and they fund it for a period of time. So how would you solve it forever? Maybe it's not solvable. Boost didn't tell me that too. All right. So we had some feedback. Yeah, we're going to read in this week's episode. Since this is a pre-record, we don't have your boost in this one. But we did have an angry kid write the show. So I'm really glad we opened up the inbox.
Oh, wonderful.
I'll try. But apparently the Zoomers don't like to use all the letters anymore. But he writes, no, Chris, NVIDIA is the king, all caps, of AI right now. Apple, which is misspelled, is fumbling around with their S on their CPUs, as is AMD on their mobile CPUs. But at the end of the day, NVIDIA kills. The memory bandwidth of general purpose compute cards, effectively any modern NVIDIA GPU, absolutely, all caps, slaughters Apple and AMD and their feeble CPUs. Sure, they are theoretically high throughput, which they never achieve because they are bandwidth starved. There's a reason that thousands of NVIDIA GPUs are used to train, all caps, these models and not thousands of shitty MacBooks with their half-baked NPUs. Clearly, the point I was making was for the end user consumption. When you're looking at spending $1,000 and all you can spend is $1,000, then I think people are looking at those MacBooks and thinking, oh, maybe I could run it in a little bit. At least I can do other things. I wasn't talking about training models. That's ridiculous. Peter wrote into the show, too. Another email. How about that? Coming in hot off the emails. He says, what are your thoughts on using LocalStack for local development? It looks interesting. It's essentially AWS services on your local network. So I was looking at this mic before the show. And what they try to promise is a cloud development platform that lets you build out and test your serverless applications on a local machine. And they write, quote, at its core, it features a service emulator that runs in a single container on your laptop or in your CI environment. With LocalStack, you can run your AWS application or Lambdas entirely on your local machine without connecting to remote cloud providers. That seems pretty, pretty neat.
It's an interesting idea. I mean, this is one of those dreams I've had for a long time that I am very skeptical of because I've been promised this kind of thing before.
Yeah. It would be really great, though, for, like, testing and...
Yeah, right, once, you know, run everywhere, too, right? So I would be super happy, right?
I'd love to hear if anybody's tried this. It does come with a quick start and all of that. They say, our mission is to give developers back control of their environments and free them from wasting time with inefficient dev and test loops in the cloud so they can instead focus on developing great products that solve the world's problems. Well, that's a goal. That seems pretty good.
Yeah, it would be super good.
I will look at it more, and if anybody has any experience with it, I think the idea that I find appealing is being able to do a lot of that R&D and testing on your local machine and saving yourself on your bill, but also just saving, uploading and downloading. And there's a few things that I work with here for production. It's like every time I have to upload and wait for it to process and then download it again, I just wish I could run it all locally. Even if my machine's a little slower, it'd save me times with the uploads and the downloads and the waiting to transfer.
Oh, for sure. I mean, just the ingress costs, yeah, the bandwidth costs are.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. All right. So I had a question to wrap up with for you. What do you think about Netflix's formula of releasing the whole season in one go? You know, so like what Star Trek does is once a week, like the old school way, for 10 weeks or something, they sometimes they take a break. And they drip drop the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
That lets them, you know, kind of release before it's finished too. But also, I think it might extend the discussion around them more because people are talking about it for weeks where nobody's talking about the three-body problem anymore. It like it got like attention for 1 week and then that's it. What do you think of it? Do you think this is kind of a crappy model in the sense of building hype? Because I just finished three-body problem. Great show.
Okay, yeah.
You're the only guy I've heard talk about it. You're the only one. I think it misses some of the attention because of the model. I mean, I like having all the episodes at once. I'll tell you that. I prefer to consume it that way. But I definitely think it's kind of a bummer because people are missing out on a great show.
So I totally agree with you. I prefer to consume it this way because, you know, life is hectic. It's hard to like, you know, event TV, what do they call that?
Yeah, I think so.
There's a name for it. Yeah, event TV, whatever. So is Star Trek getting more attention because of the content or because of the release schedule?
Well, I think people are fascinated by Star Trek, but I think it gets the attention every week because it is Star Trek.
No, it is, because every blog can write, right? Every yeah, blog can right. write the one
YouTube.
Post a week. YouTube, mm-hmm. okay.
Yeah, YouTube's always showing me like these, you know, every week the Star Trek, the breakdown of the Star Trek Discovery episode.
And you know, this is funny, but just to kind of the business of software development and like, you know, being in the software business, it's true. Like there's a diminishing return on how much content you post in a week. You kind of want to drip it out, even if it's already done. So why wouldn't right. it be the same for the actual content business? Yeah. All right. I'll buy that.
Our friends over at Nextcloud do a new release every quarter. Every quarter, it's a new release, and that's sort of a cadence that they set, right? You see Linux distros every 6 months for some of them. It's like, and when in between releases, nobody talks about it very much. Anyways, I do want to co-sign Three Body Problem. I really enjoyed it. I don't know if it's like Westworld good, but it's pretty good. It's a pretty good show. And you were right. Thank you for the recommendation. Now I got to wait, what, 2 years for season two?
Yeah.
Ugh, tell you what. I'll tell you what. Anyways, I just wanted to bring that up, and I'd like to know what people think too. Do you like the release at all model? Like, imagine podcasts. Imagine if we recorded all of the podcasts at once for Coda Radio for like 6 months or whatever, and then just dropped them all, and you got like instead of getting an episode every week, which would be more episodes, you got like 10 or 15 episodes, but they all were released at once.
It would be worse. It would be worse. It wouldn't be good for us and it wouldn't be good for them.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I think people wouldn't listen as much. Well, anyways, we can move on. But thank you, everybody, for listening. If you'd like to boost the show and let us know what you think, go get a new podcast app at podcastapps.com or go to coder.show/contact and use that contact page and email into the show. What about you, Mr. Dominic? Is there anywhere you want to send people before we scoot out of here?
Go to alice.dev or find me on LinkedIn or Twitter. It's at Dumanuco.
Business?
Yeah, there you go. You can find me, chrislast.com, or head on over to jupiterbroadcasting.com and check out all the great pods over there. Just getting our Texas Linux coverage out the door, maybe, or will soon over at Linux Unplugged as you're hearing this episode. We went down to Austin, no doubt ran into some Coder fans down there, ate some good barbecue. I don't know, I'm a time traveler, I can't tell you that. But you'll find all of that coverage at jupiterbroadcasting.com. Thanks so much for tuning this week's episode. We will be back next week, Tuesday, at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, at our regular live time. You can tune in at jblive.fm. We appreciate that. Of course, you can always send us a note, leave a message. We'll get them here on the show. Appreciate that, too. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.